ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர்க், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் இம்ப்ரூவிங் பிஹேவியர் பார்ட் 7, பிகமிங் மோர் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் பார்ட் 1, பிகமிங் மோர் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் பார்ட் 2. பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க்யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
This is pretty long here. I'll summarize it. I want to end in a couple of minutes, but the idea that's coming up is not a remedy, it's just a statement, is that part of the problem in anger is the home is looked at as an acceptable place to let off steam. You know, we're upset with things. We're upset with the people at work, so we come home and we complain to our spouse and let out all our frustration at home. The wife is raising an infant and going through all the demands of taking care of the infant all day and is somewhat frustrated. The husband walks in the door and the wife lets out her frustration on her husband. You know, we're letting off steam in the home. We're considering the home as the acceptable place to express all these emotions. Guru Dev says we shouldn't do that. We should look at the home as a temple. And we want to turn our home into a temple-like vibration. So would you go to the temple and let off all your steam frustrations that same way? No, of course you wouldn't. The temple is special, so you go there and you're on your best behavior. So likewise, we want to change our attitude toward the home if we feel that this is acceptable place to let off our frustrations. We have to say, no, it's not. We are creating a temple. I am turning my home into a temple. God lives here. I live in the back room. So it's a wonderful idea. But to keep it short, the explanation is, well, do something else. You know, let your steam off between the office and the home. Go somewhere else. You know, go to a gymnasium, exercise. Lots of places you can exercise. Let off your energy that way. Take a walk to some place that's beautiful. You know, walk through a park, walk to the beach. Attune yourself to nature. Feel better about life and get rid of that sense of frustration. Don't bring it home from the office. Get rid of it. And likewise, the wife, if she's home all the time taking care of infants and so forth, can go out and go to an exercise place. Go out, take a walk, go out, be with friends, and make sure she just doesn't build up all this frustration. So when the husband walks in the door, the poor husband gets all of it. She needs to get out too and not think it's acceptable to behave that way in the home. Get rid of the frustrations somewhere else. So there's a couple more remedies for anger. Let's now look at some of the specific remedies. Specific remedy means we're angry at a specific person, like our father. We never forgave him for this or that. Grumble, grumble. You know, we're upset with our father for something. So the first specific remedy is the flower penance, which is for a situation you are angry with a specific person for events that took place in the past. This applies to resentment toward parents as to how they raised you, anger toward a spouse because of a specific events that took place and for which you have definitely not forgiven him or her, serious problems between siblings, resentment of how your employer is constantly mistreating you, and so forth. You're mad at a specific person. Put up a picture of the person toward which you are angry, and for 31 days, place a flower in front of the picture. While doing so, sincerely forgive the person in heart and mind. When it becomes difficult to offer the flower of forgiveness, because hurtful memories come up from the subconscious mind, perform the Vasanada Tantra, writing down the hurtful memories and burning the paper in a trash can. Say, I forgive you, for I know that you gave back to me the karma that I set in motion. So that's what we call the flower penance. Lots of Gurudeva Shishya have done it and gotten rid of resentments they held for 10, 20, 30 years, you know, against a parent or a relative or someone, and it works out very well. Second remedy is when serious anger has been expressed toward a member of the immediate family. So this remedy, you know, there's a tendency for certain kinds of people, when they get angry, they'll gladly fast or something. You know, it's too easy. So this is hard. So sometimes I give this one. Because you have to help the other person that you got angry at. So the remedy, this is for serious anger which has been expressed toward a member of the immediate family. The remedy is to do three kindly acts you had not previously planned to do for each expression of anger. For example, if a husband shouts at his wife at length, he could then take her out to dinner, buy her an item she really needs for the kitchen, and give her some extra free time by taking care of the younger children for a half day. So that's very effective, because you really have to help the other person that you hurt. So it's karmically, it's very good, because you're actually helping them more in return than you hurt them. So karmically, it's balancing out. Plus, it's impressing you on helping people rather than hurting them through anger. In summary, anger is something that can be controlled by acknowledging that it is a serious problem that easily leads to violence and is a quality that should be absent from those serious about making progress in their spiritual life. Om Namah Shivaya. So we're continuing today on our series, talking about the Guru and the role of the Guru. So we have a new quote from Gurudeva, chapter 47, the spirit of the Guru, to start with. Hindu temples sustain Hinduism around the world. Scriptures keep us always reminded of the path we are on and the path we are supposed to be on. But only from the Satguru can you get the spirit, the Shakti, the sustaining spirit, to make it all come to life in you, to make the temple meaningful and to complement the scriptures with your own sight, your own third eye sight. Otherwise, it's just words. Nadas are not on the path of words. The Rishi wandered down from the Himalayas to Bangalore. What did he say? Nobody knows. Whom did he talk to? Nobody knows. Did he influence crowds of people? Perhaps. But he had only to influence one individual, Kadait Swami, to speak out to the world. Kadait Swami caught the spirit of the Rishi, who had caught the spirit of the previous Rishi and all the ones that preceded him. It is that spirit of Sampradaya that gives the traditional teachings meaningful, that gives the traditional teachings meaning, that gives you the power to discriminate between what is real within those teachings and what is superfluous or just plain nonsense, that gives you the power to blend Siddhanta with Vedanta, Vedas with Agamas. The irreversible spirit of the Guru carries through all of the Shishyas. It is basically the only gift a Guru can give, that sustaining spirit. He doesn't have to give knowledge, because that has already been written down. He doesn't have to build temples, because there are more than enough temples for everyone. The rare and precious gift that he can convey is the inner spirit of his religious heritage. That is his unique gift to the world. Nadas do not follow the way of words. Kadait Swami spoke to a lot of people. Who knows what he said? They didn't have tape recorders in those days, and doubtless he never wrote anything down, but the spirit carried through him to Chelapa Guru, who didn't say an awful lot. He wasn't following the way of words either. He spoke only divine essences of the philosophy. He didn't write 3,000 verses like Rishi Tirumular did, nor did he give lectures to crowds like Kadait Swami did. His spirit was passed on to the Satguru Siva Yogaswami, who passed his spirit on to a lot of devotees. So let's review. Some of us weren't here previously, and some of us may have forgotten some of our 5 points. So we've made up a list of the the five major tasks that a guru does. First, the guru provides encouragement to continue to strive and move forward. He encourages us to keep striving even when we are going through difficult times in our life. He also encourages us to strive to achieve more than we would otherwise. Second, the guru helps develop a spiritual self-concept. Whatever self-concept we bring to him, be it one of self-doubt or one of great pride, the guru helps us move beyond it and identify with our spiritual nature so that we truly feel ourselves to be a divine being. Third, the guru speaks the teachings, and by listening to his spoken word, we have insights into the teachings far greater than we can acquire on our own by simply reading his books. Fourth, the guru helps us improve our behavior through focusing on our weakest areas as well as giving us guidelines as to how we, as a spiritual person, should behave. And fifth, the guru provides initiation to quicken our unfoldment. So today we wanted to take a simple look at initiation, diksha, and the way that Gurudeva has outlined it. We prepare for diksha by fulfilling vows or vrata. So vrata is the good preparation for diksha. What exactly is a vow? Gurudeva describes a vrata or vow as a sacred trust. He says that people make little promises and break them, but this is not a vrata. A vow is also never only to oneself. A vow is always to God, gods and guru, community, and respected elders. It is a sacred trust with God, gods and guru made at a most auspicious time in one's life. Vrata is a binding force, binding the external mind to the soul and the soul to the divine. So let's look at some examples. A common type of vow is making a promise to observe certain religious practices in a strict manner. Often these vratas relate to a specific day of the month or a deity festival. An individual takes a vow to fast on the 13th day of each lunar fortnight, known as Pradosha Vrata, for 1 year. We take a vrata for the 6 days of Skanda Shashti and then during the day fast and attend puja at the temple and eat only in the evening. The 21-day festival to Lord Ganesha, Vinayaka Vratam, incorporates vrata in the name of the festival itself, and is often observed in the same way as Skanda Shashti, fasting during the day and attending Ganesha Puja, and then eating at night. For Taipusam, many devotees fast and follow other disciplines for days in advance, and then on the Taipusam day carry kavadi, a wooden frame carried on the shoulders. Certain pilgrimages also have vratas associated with them. An example is the Sabarimala pilgrimage to Lord Ayyappan. In this case, a vrata is taken covering the restrictions that are followed both during the 41 days prior to the pilgrimage, as well as during the pilgrimage itself, which includes dietary restrictions and the practice of brahmacharya. So for 41 whole days, before you start the pilgrimage, you're following the vrata. And Shankaranathan did that recently. You can ask him about it. It is interesting to note that Gurudeva often spoke of pilgrims coming to worship God Shiva at our Sanmarga sanctuary as following a strictness similar to Sabarimala, where they would prepare themselves ahead of time for many days by fasting and other sadhanas. In the four examples given, the vrata is for a fixed period of time and then is over. The Pradosha Vrata example was for 1 year. Skanda Shashti lasts only 6 days, Vinayaka Vratam 21 days, and Sabarimala until the pilgrimage is completed. There are more advanced vows, such as those taken with a guru for a lifetime. Gurudeva established three such vows for a shishya to fulfill: the Shakahara or vegetarian vrata, which governs diet; the Parampara or lineage vrata, which governs spiritual studies; and the Dasama Bhaga or tithing vrata, which governs finance. Specifically, The vegetarian vow builds character through the control of appetite, which is the control of the instinctive mind. So this is an interesting point. In other words, as control of our appetite increases, the control of the other instinctive emotions, such as anger and jealousy, also improves. It all naturally moves along together. The lineage vow builds character through control of mental and philosophical ramification, which is control of the intellect. Traditionally, giving all loyalties to a lineage precludes all extraneous training and requires closing off intellectual inroads to all other lineages, not reading their books, not taking their courses. This vow harnesses the tendency to jump from teacher to teacher in search of new studies and techniques rather than staying with one's current study and a set of techniques and perfecting it. So that's a common problem in following religious life these days. It's quite popular. You study with one teacher for a while and then you move on to the next and then you move on to the next. And you never perfect what you learn. You're always learning something new, but you never stick with it. So the Parampara Vrata helps us stick with it and follow one tradition, taking it into the experiential realm. And the last vow that Gurudeva gave us is the tithing vow builds character through the control of money, which is the control of desire. Lots of desires are fulfilled by spending money to acquire possessions. As soon as we get our paycheck, we rush to the store to buy something we just can't live without. And a few months later, we stop using it altogether and find something else we just can't live without and buy that. Sound familiar? So, those are vratas. There's a beautiful description of initiation or diksha from Gurudeva, which begins our chapter 11 in the Saivadharma Shastras, where he says, karma, the flow of life. It's a very interesting definition of karma, is the flow of life. Karma, the flow of life, is regulated and brought under control through diksha, initiation, the placing of a special life-changing religious impression deep into the mind of the devotee. Dikshas catalyze unfoldment, granting access to new areas of inner consciousness by enlivening the kundalini power in the initiate. So one of the important aspects of diksha is that diksha goes along with a practice. The first practice, of course, is a mantra. So you're given diksha for a specific mantra, and the diksha has a certain power. But if you don't do the mantra regularly, the power of the diksha dissipates. So the two things go together, and that's one reason why Gurudeva asks everyone to master vratas first, which shows we're disciplined and consistent, because there's no point in giving an initiation to someone who won't be consistent in the practice. So the power of the initiation is sustained by doing what we're supposed to do every day. So the first initiation, these are traditional Saivite Diksha, or Saivite initiation, is called Samaya Diksha, also called Mantra Diksha, and empowers one to chant the Panchakshara Mantra, Om Namah Shivaya, on a mala of Rudraksha Japa beads. So that's the first initiation that Gurudeva has defined for us, called Samaya Diksha, or Mantra Diksha, and the practice we're supposed to do to sustain that initiation, to sustain the power we're given, is to do the Panchakshara Mantra at least 108 times every day. And that sustains the power of the initiation. Otherwise, it dissipates. So, describing the other dikshas briefly, we're not trying to get into them in detail. Vishesha Diksha empowers one to perform daily the Saiva Atmartha Puja. Doing a Shiva Puja in our home is the second diksha that Gurudeva has defined for us. And again, unless we do the puja every day, Gurudeva lets us skip it on weekends, but unless we do it every day, we dissipate the power that the diksha we receive during the diksha. Then a couple of the ones the monks get Nirvana Diksha, which marks the beginning of tapas and the serious practice of yoga. Then, of course, Gurudeva also outlines Sannyasa Diksha, making someone a sannyasin, and Acharya Diksha, making someone an acharya. So those are some thoughts on Diksha, as it's one of the five tasks of the Guru to give Diksha, and Gurudev, of course, is established a strict tradition. You know, these days, sometimes you can go to a weekend seminar, and by the end of the seminar, you've gotten Diksha. Gurudev is not that easy. So he'll make you work for it for a few years and take your vratas first and show that you're worthy of it, that you'll be able to sustain the power of the Diksha. So it requires more than a weekend seminar. It requires a number of years of preparation before, in Gurudeva's system, Diksha is given. So, continuing our subject we were on yesterday, we have a couple of new areas. The subject was becoming a more spiritual person and how we can do that. And yesterday we looked at the yama of ahimsa, the first yama, and we were looking specifically at the refined areas of it, because no one here goes around hitting people. You know, it's not a question of such simple physical violence. You know, the group here is way beyond physical violence, but that doesn't mean we can't improve in upholding the yama. So we were talking yesterday about how often we hurt people with our words, and we reviewed that, and also how sometimes we hurt people with our words because we've gotten angry, and therefore controlling anger is an important part of fulfilling ahimsa. So today we're moving to a new area, which is learning from our mistakes, becoming a more spiritual person through learning from our mistakes. And I'll read, this was from an editorial in Hinduism Today a couple issues ago. For all of mankind, no matter where one is on the path, spiritual advancement comes from improving one's behavior. Said another way, it comes from learning from one's mistakes. Unfortunately, this process is often inhibited by the idea that somehow we are not supposed to make mistakes. We grow up being scolded by our parents. We grow up being scolded for our mistakes by our parents. Some teachers ridicule students when they make mistakes. Supervisors at work yell at workers when they make a mistake. No wonder many adults feel terrible when they make a mistake. Therefore, to spiritually benefit from our mistakes, we need a new attitude toward them, which Gurudeva describes as mistakes are wonderful opportunities to learn. Mistakes are wonderful opportunities to learn. So the story I give to try and impress that point is of a young family, the wife, let's say a five-year-old. You know, the wife is at home taking care of the five-year-old, and the five-year-old makes some horrendous mistake and almost burns the house down. And so the wife calls up the husband and says, "Dear, you'll be so happy to hear this news. You know, our son made this huge mistake today. He almost burned the house down. Isn't this wonderful? You know, he has such a wonderful opportunity here to learn an important lesson, and I wanted you to think about it on your way home. You know, what lesson do we need to teach him so he doesn't make this mistake again?" Okay, well, the story, by the smiles, you get the point, is that unfortunately, parents don't think that way. These are parents of a rare breed. Usually it's just a question of punishment. But punishment misses the point if it's not, doesn't go along with a teaching, so that you're helping the child learn how not to repeat the mistake. You know, quite often punishment is all that happens, but the important point is the child doesn't know something. Otherwise, he never would have made the mistake. There's some knowledge the child is missing. And the parents need to figure out what that knowledge is. You know, it's fine to punish the child in a reasonable way, but has to be done without emotion and along coupled with trying to help the child not repeat the mistake through figuring out what the child needs to learn. And, of course, whose responsibility is it to teach the child? It's the parents. You know, so the child made a mistake because the parents didn't teach the child something. So that's the point. So moving on, we have four reactions to making a mistake. So a common first reaction to having made a mistake is to become upset that we made the mistake, get emotional about it, or if it is a serious mistake, to become quite burdened and even depressed. That is a natural first reaction, but if it is our only reaction, it is not enough. We need to deal with the emotional reaction to the action and move on to the learning stage. So I'll read the second reaction. Thus, a good second reaction to a mistake is to think clearly about what happened and why the mistake occurred and find a way to not repeat the mistake in the future. Perhaps we were not being careful enough and resolving to be more careful next time will prevent the problem from occurring. Perhaps we did not know something and now we have that knowledge and can simply resolve to use that knowledge next time. Perhaps we created unintended consequences that caused significant problems to us or others. Now that we are aware of the consequences, we certainly won't repeat the action. Those who are striving to live a spiritual life are self-reflective and learn quickly from their mistakes. In fact, one way to tell a young soul from an old soul is to observe how quickly he learns not to repeat the same mistakes. So, quite often I get an email in from someone who made a mistake. And they're saying, oh, I shouldn't have done this. And I mentioned this the other day. And, of course, that's just getting stuck at the first level of reaction. I shouldn't have done this. I'm sorry. But I encourage them to move on to the second level, and instead of saying I shouldn't have done it, to say I shouldn't do it again. You know, that's the point we're striving for. Not to simply feel sorry that we made a mistake, but to commit to not making it again, or at least trying not to make it again. You know, taking that step is being self-reflective. And it's how we progress on the spiritual path. Because the spiritual path is a series of experiences, and sometimes we make mistakes. And so if we can learn from those mistakes and learn to not make them again, then we progress. If we're constantly making the same mistake over and over and over again, we're not progressing. So there's nothing wrong with making the mistake. We don't want to say, I shouldn't have made the mistake. We want to say, I shouldn't make the same mistake again. So we'll come back to that point in a minute. A third reaction may be needed if the mistake involved other people. Perhaps we have hurt their feelings or created a strain between us. A direct apology can fix this if we know the person well. However, in many situations, we are not close enough to the individual to be able to apologize. In that case, a generous act toward them can adjust the flow of feelings back into a harmonious condition. For example, hold a small dinner party and include them among the guests. So that's the third reaction we have to. If we make a mistake and it's upset other people, we have to fix that upset. It's more than just ourselves involved. A fourth reaction may be needed if the mistake is a major misdeed. For example, if we did something that was dishonest. In this case, even though we have resolved to not repeat the misdeed, apologize to those involved, we may well still feel bad about having done it. In this case, we need to perform some form of penance, prayaschitta, to rid ourselves of the sense of feeling bad about ourselves. Typical forms of penance are to fast, perform 108 prostrations before the deity, or walking prostrations up a sacred path or around the temple. nice story. A young couple was here recently, and the wife was explaining how she'd been raised, and one of the practices that the whole family did, including the kids, when they went to Tirupati Temple, was they would get up at 3 a.m, bathe in their clothes, and then roll around the temple in their clothes. So this was even the young children. So I was quite impressed. That's prayaschitta. Okay, so we have a 5-minute exercise. You need your paper and pen there. And so our spirit here is trying to improve our behavior. So in this case, take 5 minutes and look for one or more significant mistakes you made in the last few years that you have not yet thought about how to avoid repeating. So look for a mistake, significant one in the last couple of years, and you haven't yet thought about this question: how can I avoid doing this again? And then see if in 5 minutes you can figure out a way not to repeat the mistake through applying new knowledge, through some understanding, through understanding the unintentional consequences. In some way, figure out how you can avoid doing it again. Okay, so we'll take 5 minutes on that.